Part 4, Chapter 8, Paragraph 1. 321. In my old position. I don't know if this is going to be able to get the old position.
Chapter 8, Paragraph 1.
Part 4, Chapter 8, Paragraph 1.
It's 340 on the other one.
Yesterday, at the end, they talked about Atomic Tematza, the fact that if the little leg of the hay rises, it will become a chess. The difference is Atomic Tematza is simply leavening. They are made of the same materials, exactly the same five species of grain. Now, Hal says that Chometz is associated with physicality, and physicality is the condition in which God's presence is hidden. All of that, he says. And then that would mean that Matzah escapes that condition. Now, I just want to add one thought here, which I think expresses this idea physically in these substances. Imagine that you had never seen bread. You go to the store, and you see a loaf of bread sitting on the shelf. You've never seen bread. You've never had any contact with it. And you pick it up. I think you're going to be quite surprised. What will surprise you? It will be very light. Because bread is a very large measure of air. Take a piece of bread and squeeze it. You can squeeze it to much smaller than the size of the slice when you start out. That is to say, in the leavening process, you introduce air so that the end product looks much bigger than its substance really is. I don't know if you've heard of a blowfish. You know what a blowfish is? It has a big pouch. And when it's attacked or feels it's in trouble, it blows into that pouch, and the pouch expands. And it looks much bigger than it really is. I guess it doesn't blow air, right? It blows water to the pouch or something. Fills it up with something or other. So here, leavened flour products present a false appearance of size. That's what they do. Now, I think that's a kind of expression of the idea of nature. Nature presents a false appearance of its size, its meaning, its solidity, its substance. Really, as we know, nature is just the more repetitive aspects of what God creates. God creates everything. Only sometimes he repeats according to repeated patterns, and sometimes he creates things that aren't according to repeated patterns. What we call nature is just the patterns, the repeated patterns of his creation. But it doesn't look that way. And it's easy for a person to be taken in by the illusion that what's called nature is an independent existence, an independent existence that operates on its own in a mechanical fashion. And Chometz is part of that natural appearance. And Chometz attracts a person's desires, which then orient him towards the illusion. So it's all part of a package deal. The package deal is drawing the person into the illusion. And that's why matzah, in its physical nature, matzah, what you see is what you get. There are no surprises. There are no hidden pockets. It's a flat cracker. And that being the case, it represents an aspect of truth where the substance of it is observable on the surface, as against bread, but that's not true. By the way, when you're used to that destructive, worthless, nutritionless white bread, and you get a pumpernickel, or you get a good rye bread, and you're surprised at how heavy they are. And even they have a considerable amount of air in them, but you're surprised at how heavy they are, because That's bread. Bread. The other stuff is okay. Giving into my idea. Fine. That's the idea of chametz and matzah. Now, he doesn't deal with the other aspects of Pesach, and I'm going to skip them. Sukkot, he says things that are very, very deep and very important for us. I don't know if I can do more than just mention them. I can't really make them any more connected to our reality. The clouds of glory in the wilderness had a number of benefits. First of all, they filtered out the UVF rays and monitored the temperature and humidity so that it was comfortable. And as they traveled, it flattened the terrain. So that it was like a climate and environment control, providing a comfortable existence. But more than that, this is the same theme that I've told you over and over again, they're connected to some higher spiritual energy, and being under the care of those clouds created a reality for those people totally divorced from the other nations of the world. You got to do it with resolution, guys. Come on, you're stronger than the door. Make up your mind, you're going to close it. I don't even mind if it bangs. Well, give it a push and see if it's closed. No, you're sure it's closed. Okay. Did it twice. Okay. Taking bets? Give me 2-1. Okay. Let's recall. Being expelled from the Garden of Eden meant that the whole creation went down a giant step. If everybody went down the giant step, so then it would be impossible to recover. So somebody had to represent the prior reality. And that was open to everybody. And Adam and Abraham achieved it for himself and for all his descendants, for the nation that came out of it. And everybody was invited to join. And the people could have joined at the time of Sinai. All nations could have joined us, and they didn't join us. So we alone represent that higher reality. We don't possess it. We're not living in the Garden of Eden right now, but we are the ones who represent it in this lower reality. So our condition is a condition unlike everybody else. And we said in part two that for that reason, we are able by our actions to perfect the whole of creation, which is not true of the other nations. All they can do is perfect their own condition. So our spiritual essence in the world is quite different from that of other peoples. Now, that was triggered at Sinai. The fulfillment of that process started from Abraham, was triggered at Sinai. The clouds of glory represent the fact, they express the fact, that our relationship to the world around us is unlike the relationship of other nations. Now, with the clouds of glory, we walked on the ground. And the breezes did reach us. And the sunlight did reach us. But we weren't subject to the punishment of the environment walking through a desert. Because it was filtered and applied in such a way as to protect us and to benefit us. Which is a symptom of the fact that the physical world appreciates the ones who represent this higher principle. This is why Abraham experienced miracles, and Isaac experienced miracles, and Jacob experienced miracles, because the physical world appreciates someone who, by his actions, can bring it to its perfection. So the gods of glory represent that higher state that the Jewish people represented immediately after Sinai. Now, of course, this was supposed to be a limited event. According to some, we go to Sinai, receive the Torah, Moses comes down with the tablets, and goes straight into the land of Israel. would have been a matter of a few months. According to others, the tabernacle had to be constructed, so it would take a little longer, maybe a year. But that's all. After that, the plan was to go into the land of Israel, go back to living with nature, and to sanctify the natural world as well. As it was, they had the rebellion of the spies, and they had to spend 40 years in the wilderness. So they had it for 40 years. That wasn't the plan. But the idea that there will be a period of time under the care of the clouds, representing and expressing our higher relationship to the world, that was planned from the beginning. Whether it will be 4 months or a year, and then it ended up 40 years, but the existence of that condition is something which was planned from the beginning. Now, we celebrate this by dwelling in the sukkah. The sukkah is not to commemorate the huts that they built as they went through the wilderness, although they did build huts, and one of the Tanoim does say that that's what it's for. But the other Tanoim says that that's not what it's for, it's really to commemorate the clouds, and so it is decided. By the way, just a little footnote for those who have a taste for Jewish law, a text of Jewish law. We're talking now about symbolism. I want you to know that in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law, it is explicitly stated that the sukkahs that we dwell in commemorate, symbolize the clouds of glory that accompany this world, and not the booths that they lived in. Now, the commentators ask, the Shulchan Aruch is a book of law and custom, telling you what to do. It's not a book of symbolism. It's not a book of homiletics. It's not a book of philosophy. It's a book of law. Why would there be a decision in the Shulchan Aruch as to which one of these symbolisms is correct? The simplest answer is that when you sit in the sukkah, it's another theme that I've mentioned to you at least an infinity of times, your brain has to be online. Your brain has to be online whatever you do. Well, then knowing the symbolism is important. Now here, two times, I'm split on what the symbolism is. The difference for us is, what am I supposed to think about when I'm sitting in the sukkah? Especially since there's a verse that describes the sukkah as having this purpose. It says, you should sit in the sukkah, l'man teidu ki sukkos hashavti esbnei Yisrael l'otzi yisam v'yos v'sraim, so that you shall know that I caused the children of Israel to dwell in sukkos when I took them out of Egypt. So if the verse says, I want you to sit there in order for you to know, it's important to know what it is I'm supposed to know. If I'm supposed to know that they were living in booths, am I supposed to know that they were protected by the clouds of glory? And if it should occur to you to ask, if the verse says, in order for you to know I caused the children of Israel to dwell in Sukkot, how then could it be the clouds of glory? So I want you to know that the word sukkah is a shortened form of the word tzach, which is what we say the roof should be made of. Because the word tzach means that which protects you overhead. That's based on one of the verses in the prophets. That's what the verse means. And that's why, for those who know a little Jewish law, that's why all the conditions about the materials out of which the roof shall be made, and there are many such conditions, apply only to the roof. They don't apply to the walls at all. Why not? If it's all sukkah, how come there are only rules for the roof? The answer is, sukkah really means roof. And the walls are there, holding up the roof and providing privacy and causing it to be a dwelling place. But the word sukkah really refers to the roof. No, if it refers to the roof, it means it refers to the thing overhead that's protecting you. Well, in the wilderness, the thatched roofs were not what protected them. What protected them were the clouds of glory, which were over them. So, QED. A little of an esoteric, beyond my ability to explain it all. I can't even do anything about it. Hanukkah and Purim. Let's talk a little bit about Hanukkah and Purim. I'm going to talk about Hanukkah at night time next week at some length. But here I'll just give you some chapter heading. Hanukkah and Purim are really very different holidays. The historical events were very different, and there's a fascinating Chafetz Chaim where he says what we are supposed to learn from them. And what we're supposed to learn from them, I think, is quite radical. This is something I don't usually teach in yeshiva, because the boys might get carried away. In the case of Hanukkah, we had a foreign power that opposed Jewish observance. The Assyrian Greeks wanted to Hellenize us. Hellenize is the fancy word for Greekify. They wanted to Greekify. Teach us to think like Greeks and behave like Greeks. Purim, the threat was annihilation. Annihilation of every man, woman, and child. They didn't care what ideas you had in your head. You could pledge allegiance to the Persian gods. It would have made absolutely no difference. They just wanted to kill out all the Jews. Now, look at the responses in the two cases. In the case of Purim, the response was tshuva, sackcloth, ashes, fasting, weeping, praying. In the case of Hanukkah, the reaction was war. Those who were faithful to God and to the Torah went to war. They started a guerrilla warfare. Both were successful. Both were successful. So the Chafetz Chaim said, we ought to learn from history that the way we respond depends upon the kind of threat we're facing. If the threat is force applied to compromise Torah observance, then we ought to respond with warfare. If the threat applied is annihilation, then we ought to respond with tshuva, repentance, prayer. And the Chafetz Chaim said, in the 20th century, now he died in 1933, in the 20th century we missed the boat. Because in Russia, as a result of the Russian Revolution, the Russian government set up a systematic attempt to wipe out, really, all religious practice, but because there's a healthy strain of anti-Semitism in Russia, applied to Judaism very stringently in particular. Said the Chafetz Chaim, Jews of the time should have taken to the forests and stolen guns and fought against the Russian communists, because that's what our ancestors, the Maccabees, did against the Assyrian Greeks. Fascinating analysis. Now, if you follow that analysis, it becomes unpopular. It then follows that in the Second World War period, which was our experience of Purim, where the threat was open annihilation, then taking to the forests and joining the partisans and all that Wild West gory glory was totally irrelevant. In fact, it did nothing. In fact, it did nothing. Many of the Jewish partisans were killed by the Poles, and it did really nothing to slow down the German war machine or the exterminations. But from the point of view of Jewish history, it was the wrong response. The response should have been mass Jewry, and it didn't happen in either case.
Is that nowadays that you should rather just current environment, you shouldn't fight back if you'd rather just be more observant and
faithful? We're not facing either of those challenges today. I'm talking about how to respond to a specific historical challenge.
Well, if you take France, they do have...
France?
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe they should take to the forest and shoot up the government. France in general is a rogue state, and they're very dangerous. I think they're more dangerous to the safety of the world than any other country. Those guys, they're not living on the same planet. They're not even serious. No, I'm talking about concerted state power. I'm not talking about anti-Semitism. I'm talking about an organized state power. I understand where your question is coming from. In the case of Haman, you had an entire state whose policy was to exterminate Jews, as there was in the case of Hitler. In the case of Mordechai, you had a government with an army that came in to force Jews to give up Judaism, as you did with Russia. Today, you don't have either of those things. So I don't see any connection between what we're facing today and either of those historical references. Today is the third condition. It needs its own response. Okay, now, let's look a little bit at the history of the war, in the case of the Maccabees. So the Greeks, the Syrians, and the Hellenized Jews, for decades or more, set up schools here, and they had athletic competitions. They introduced Greek culture in any way that they could. And finally, they were bold enough to enter the temple and perform abominations there. And a certain family of priests decided that they stepped over the red line, and they set about killing as many of the prominent Greeks as they could. This triggered a kind of rebellion, and there was guerrilla warfare, and people took to the forests and started attacking them wherever they could. Now, we eventually won that war. We chased them out of the country. Capturing Jerusalem and purifying the temple was in the middle of the war. The war was fought from south to north. Chasing them out of Galilee took months longer. When they captured the temple, they cleaned it out and started to purify it and reorganize it. And one of the things that they could do right away was light the menorah. Now, just a piece of information in terms of Jewish law. They probably didn't have the golden menorah, or if they had it, they would have had to purify it. It would have been a long and difficult process. But you don't need the golden menorah. If you have it, you should use it, but you don't need it. You can make any menorah you like. You can make it out of wood, you know, plastic. I don't care. You can make it out of anything. So the menorah wasn't the issue. But they needed oil. And you all know the story. They found exactly one vessel of oil with enough oil for one night. They burned for 8 nights. The truth is, you don't need pure oil either. You don't need pure oil. You can use tummy oil. Defiled oil, impure oil. I mean, it's tummy. Those words are. Anyway, tummy. You can use tummy oil. All of the service in the temple can be done betumah. When the public service has to be done, the only items, the only alternative you have to do is betumah, the tummy, everything can be done. The kohen can be tummy, the oil can be tummy, the food can be. It makes absolutely no difference whatsoever. So, what then is the point of the miracle? What does the miracle accomplish? The miracle accomplishes that you could do it in a better way. You do it in a better way. You could have used tummy oil. There was plenty of tummy oil. There's only one container of oil that was pure. The miracle enabled them to do the mitzvah in the best possible way. With purity. Now, again, this is for the aficionados who may have studied a little Jewish law. The mitzvah of lighting the Hanukkah lights has a legal structure unlike any other mitzvah in the entire Torah. It is a three-tiered mitzvah. There is the minimum law. The minimum law is one light per house per night. One candle per house per night. That's all. With that, you are satisfying the legal obligation. Then there's a stage called Mahadrin. You may have heard about that in the Kashrus advertisements here in the city. Mahadrin means for those who care to do it right. That's one stage up. And then there's Mahadrin, Mina Mahadrin, the ones who want to do it super right. This is the only mitzvah in the entire Torah that is written into the structure of the mitzvah, three tiers. Minimum, better, and best. And the better and best levels, I think there's a difference of opinion, which is better and which is best. But one consideration is that each person should light, not just one person should light. And another consideration is that the number of lights should reflect the number of night it is of the 8 days of Hanukkah. So we, because we're so rich, and we light those cheap candles, you did it right, you light the envelope. We're so rich that we all do it the best possible way. Everybody lights, and we light a number of lights corresponding to the number of night it is of Hanukkah. But the minimum mitzvah doesn't require that. Now why? Why would Jewish law have picked this mitzvah of all the mitzvahs in the Torah and given it a three-tiered structure, which it doesn't give to any other mitzvah in the Torah? Other mitzvahs often have two tiers, because it can be difference of opinion how it should be done. If you're more stringent, then you'll do it according to the more stringent opinion, and that's preferable. But three tiers written into the mitzvah itself? No, there is no such thing. Why? I hope the answer is obvious. I just gave it to you. Okay? If the miracle that we are commemorating, the whole point of the miracle was to be able to do something in the best possible way. Without the miracle, you could have done it anyhow. But the miracle enables you to do it in the best possible way. So Chazal, when they structured the mitzvah, built into the mitzvah the idea of doing things in the best possible way. The structure of the mitzvah reflects the impact of the miracle as it took place. Now, why am I going through this? First of all, it goes to be Hanukkah in a couple of days, and you should know this. But second of all, you have to appreciate that a great deal of sophisticated thought went into the way the mitzvahs are structured. This is just a symptom of how it works. Okay? Now, another matter. How do you think the war looked? There, you have guerrilla bands in the hills, and you have the Greek Assyrian army, which is in control of the whole area, and they're fighting skirmishes and battles. Is there a brown book here? How do you think the war looked? Were stones dropping from heaven on the enemy forces? When they went out to battle, did the earth open up and swallow up the enemy armies? Did swarms of hornets attack the enemy soldiers? When they shot arrows, did the wind turn around and blow their arrows back? What kind of battle was it? We talk about the few, the many were delivered into the hands of the few, mighty into the hands of the weak. I want you to know the Maharal says that if we had been there and we had observed the battles, we would have seen nothing out of the ordinary. No open miracles. Nothing out of the ordinary. And indeed, when you think about it, is it really so impossibly strange that the few should defeat the many? That the weak should defeat the strong? Isn't history littered with such cases? The United States of America lost the war in Vietnam. Surely America is stronger than Vietnam, but they lost it. I hope there's nobody here from Great Britain, but I'll just remind you that the Americans did win the Revolutionary War. You know, that ragtag bunch of farmers and raccoon hunters defeated the great British army and won the independence of the nation from Britain. Guerrilla warfare, when the guerrillas are locals and who are fighting for their own freedom and independence, and the soldiers are mercenaries who are fighting for money, it's not impossible for the smaller force and the weaker force to overwhelm the stronger force and the larger force. Not so impossible in history. Says the Maharal, if you would have been attached to the either side as an observer for the I was going to say the independent, but you don't want to do that because they're awful. I mean, you know, for the London Times or something like that, you would not have seen any open miraculous events. Now, very, very interesting. When you say the insert in the prayers for Hanukkah, and you know what we're commemorating. You know what we're commemorating, and you know what we do. You know how we celebrate it. So listen to what the words say. In the days of Matisyahu, the son of Yochanan, the high priest, Hasmonaim and his sons, when the wicked Greek kingdom rose up against your people Israel to make them forget your Torah, compel them to stray from the statutes of your will, you and your great mercy stood up for them in the time of their distress. You took up their grievance, judged their claim, avenged their wrong. You delivered the strong into the hands of the weak, the many into the hands of the few, the impure into the hands of the pure, the wicked into the hands of the righteous. Maybe that's miraculous, huh? And the wanton into the hands of the diligent students of your Torah. For yourself, you made a great and holy name in your world. For your people Israel, you worked a great victory and salvation to, at this very day. Thereafter, your children came to the holy of holies of your house, cleansed your temple, purified the site of your holiness, killed the lights in the courtyards of your sanctuary, establish these 8 days of Hanukkah to express thanks and praise to your great name. Anything missing?
Miracle.
How about the miracle?
Huh?
In the whole paragraph, there's not a mention of the miracle of the menorah, of the oil. It's just missing. Okay. All right. Look, that's in the prayer. Okay. Maybe we can tolerate that for whatever reason or other. We'll figure out some explanation. But if you look, when you light the Hanukkah lights, when you're going to light the candles, goodness gracious, here you are doing the mitzvah which commemorates that great miracle, right? The miracle of the menorah. Listen to the text that you say. These lights we kindle upon the miracles, the wonders, the salvations, and the battles which you performed for our forefathers in those days at this season through your holy priests. During all the 8 days of Hanukkah, these lights are sacred. We're not permitted to make ordinary use of them, but to look at them in order to express thanks and praise your great name for your miracles, wonders, and your salvations. Guess what? It's missing there too. Now here you are, with the flame in your hands, and you're ready to start lighting, and you recite this paragraph as you light, because it expresses, what does it express? It expresses the miracle of the holiday? I mean, does it express the meaning of what you're doing? You're lighting your little menorah, and it doesn't mention the miracle of oil at all. The only thing it mentions in detail is battles. Oh, there were battles. That's the war. What's going on? Well, okay, perhaps, although I just told you, the Maharal said that had you been attached to the forces, you would have seen nothing out of the ordinary.
But that's a miracle. That's
well, okay, now we have to play with the word miracle and everything else, but at least you're beginning to put two and two together.
Ordinary is a miracle.
Sorry? The ordinary is also a miracle. Okay, well, let's talk about what miracle means. But let's just register the problems now. We have two problems, right? Number one, it seems, according to Maharal, that the course of the war was nothing out of the ordinary. And on the other hand, here, actually there's three problems. Right? If the course of the war was nothing out of the ordinary, then why does the prayer classify it as a miracle? And number two, how come the prayers omit the miracle of the oil? It's really astounding. The answer, says the Maharal, is this. I mentioned the idea to you once, briefly. The problem is the word miracle has two meanings, and it's used in different contexts in different ways, and it's not really consistent. So let me try to avoid the word. I'll put the word back in afterwards. Everything that happens in the world is due to God's will. Everything comes from God's will. As I told you 17 minutes ago, some things are repetitive. Okay, I didn't really mean 17. I'm guessing a little while ago. Okay. You never know. If I said 17, let's play the tape back. I said, stop, watch and see. We're doing 17 minutes. Okay. Everything happens according to God's will. Only some things are repetitive and in categories, regular categories, and some things are not. the point of the unusual events is in large part, I wouldn't say this is the whole point, but one of the large purposes of the unusual events is to teach you the nature of the usual ones. It's not that they should stand out. I'm going to talk about this next week in great detail, but I'm telling you the bottom line, the conclusion. It's not that the unusual one should stand out as different, attract your attention, and cause you to disregard the rest. Rather, it is that the unusual ones are designed to open your eyes as to the character of all the rest. The unusual ones show God's agency. From this we are supposed to learn that the other ones, the repetitive ones, the ordinary, normal ones, also are God's agency. Now, how do they do that? Well, as we'll see next week in Yad Vashem, there are different categories and different ways, different strategies. But in the Purim case, this is how it works. I'm sorry. The Hanukkah case, this is how it works. The Assyrian Greeks are maintaining a campaign to stop Torah observance. The Kohanim, who are leaders of the people in their observance of the Torah, start a rebellion. They do so because of an abomination that takes place in the temple. They fight. And their battles are increasingly more and more successful in ways that don't look different from at least some battles in history. When they come to the temple, there's a miracle. An open, visible, public miracle. And the miracle is in the service of the temple. Now, if you were there, if you were part of this rebellion, or if you were standing on the sideline, maybe it's right, maybe it's wrong, who knows, maybe Zeus will be angry, maybe Minerva will be upset, if you believed in the Greek gods. And now you see the Kohanim leading this battle, and they come into the temple, and there is a public miracle in the service of the temple. I think you would see that as a confirmation that the war is right and that God is on their side. You would learn from the miracle of the oil that the conduct of the war is also divine providence. That's what you would learn. Because the war was conducted for the sake of purifying the temple and reinstituting the service. And immediately upon gaining re-entry and starting, it's a miracle confirming the service. This is how the miracle can reflect on the ordinary events to show what their character is. Now, what the Siddur is telling us is that the fundamental message of Hanukkah, the message you have to work on to absorb, is how to look at the ordinary. There's no danger you're going to lose sight of the miracle of the oil. That's spectacular. And after all, you're lighting the menorah. Clearly, the menorah is corresponding to the miracle of the oil. But the texts say, don't forget that what you're supposed to learn from this is not that oil is special, or Jerusalem is special, or the temple is special, or Kohanim is special. What you're supposed to learn from this is that everyday, ordinary life, you're in contact with the same divine providence. That's why in the text, the only thing that's mentioned is the war. If you don't say this, you have a gigantic problem. And I must tell you, I'm a little disappointed from people who are raised in religious families from birth. You never hear this problem raised. And it is a gigantic problem. The minute you look at it, it's a disaster. It's impossible. How can it be? Now I'll tell you one more thing, which reflects this, I think, in great measure. Does anybody know what the date was when they entered the temple? 25th of Kislev. The way you remember that is they take the word Hanukkah and break it up. Chanu, cafe. They achieved a kind of... they reached a level of encampment or solidity on 25th. Chanu, cafe. 25th. And therefore, we celebrate Hanukkah 8 days starting on the 25th of Kislev. This is not right, boys and girls. It's not right. Because if they entered the temple on the 25th, when do you light the menorah? At what time of day? At night. You light the menorah at night. So when did they light the menorah the first time? On the 26th. So why do we start on the night of the 25th? We're a day off.
So maybe they entered on the 24th, and that's why it's called Hanukkah.
What's that?
Maybe they entered on the 24th.
Yeah, but the Gemara says they entered on the 25th. So we're not guessing.
Maybe they lit it right when they walked in. They realized they didn't.
Well, the implication is it was the day of the 25th. It wasn't they didn't enter the night time. You don't light it in the daytime. There's a Rambam who says you light it twice a day, but...
They wouldn't have been allowed to enter on the 25th, see if there was no light, and just quickly light it, even though it wasn't...
No, in fact, the amount of oil that you put in was enough to let it burn all night. There's no mitzvah for it to burn in the daytime. In the morning you clean it out, the evening you light it. Okay, now, the Beis Yosef has a famous kasha. We'll put the two things together. I'm telling you now, I think it's the Prima Gadol. The Beis Yosef has a famous kasha. They found one night's supply of oil, right? Good. How long did it burn? 8 nights. So how much miracle was there?
Seven.
You had enough oil to burn one. It burned eight. It's a miracle of seven. If that's true, how come we light 8 nights? We got one extra night, boys and girls. One extra night. Yes. And that night is for the war. That night we're lighting for the war. Because that's the night of the day in which we came into the temple, where the victory brought us to the temple. We were able to clean it out. So that one extra is for the sake of the war. And that's why we start one night early. Now everything comes out kafta mafer. Everything comes out beautiful. Yeah.
In response to the attack on the kids from religious homes.
Yeah.
They never ever told us this Maharal that if you would have been there, you would have seen it.
Okay.
So everyone always thinks that it was all the miracles. And then there was also the miracle of the oil,
okay,
right? Which we all speak about. But for somebody thinking about it, you think that's a little thing that happened and a thing like a big battle. That's like, so we speak about it, you don't think about the fact of the
oil. Okay, but Haneris Halala, you have no excuse.
I'm not saying that...
Haneris Halala, you have no excuse. Because Haneris Halala, you're lighting the menorah and you don't mention the miracle of the oil. That's very strange, isn't it? Even if you thought that the war was miraculous, at least, shouldn't the oil get at least a mention? A word? You know, one word? V'Hashemen, something like that, you know?
We speak about it, but we don't make the connection, but it's...
But we say the milk, we say wine. The Aneris Halala says wine. Alei Simcha, right? V'alei Milchamos. And for the battles. It doesn't say, V'alei Shemen.
The question is not as strong as
correct.
You...
Okay, it's not as strong. I agree with you.
I mean, I don't see how the Maral, I mean, he says this, right? Yeah. But then how we keep saying the few against the many. So what's he trying to tell us over there? The weak against the strong. If it wasn't a big deal, why are you even telling it to us? How does he get that?
Let's put it this way. Not always do the weak triumph over the strong. Not always. The question is, I said I was going to put the word miracle back in. Let me do that, and then I think it'll be clear. The word miracle sometimes means something that God's will causes to happen. If that's all it means, then you can say, as some of our texts do, that everything's miraculous. You're surrounded by miracles all the time. The rising of the sun, the setting of the sun, the fact that water flows downhill, the fact that smoke goes upwards. If you're talking about, if it means just something that God's will causes, then it's fair to say that everything's miraculous. That's one usage of the word. But there's another usage of the word. For example, in Halacha it says, If you go past a location in which a miracle occurred to you, it's a special blessing to me. Now, let's suppose I walk past a water fountain where I once took a drink. Should I make the blessing? Because everything's miraculous. We're surrounded by miracles all the time. I drank water. It went into my body. My body absorbed it. Isn't that a miracle? So shouldn't I? No, no, you should not make the blessing there. Because then you'd be making the blessings all the time. Every time I come to Yeshiva, I'm making another blessing. No. That's not the pshat. There, the word miracle means an event in which God's agency is visible, obvious, open, demonstrable. That's the common use of the word miracle. We don't regard water flowing downhill as a miracle usually. So there are these two usages of the word. Now, all you have to do is be clear about what you mean when you say it. If you use the first usage that everything is a production of God's will, so everything's miraculous, then you distinguish between open miracles and hidden miracles. If you use the word miracle to mean an event in which God's action is open and obvious, then you call that miracle, and everything else you call not miraculous. It's just a matter of terminology. There's no conceptual difference whatsoever. So here, in the prayers, the Maharal will say that this is more the sense of a miracle, which is God's direct agency. And what you have to appreciate is that the war was a matter of God's direct agency, even though similar events do take place. It's certainly not a miracle in the strong sense of an event which clearly, openly, visibly shows God's agency. A person could have been there and watched the battles and not have to admit that God was performing the battles. Stones didn't fall from heaven, and the earth didn't open up, and the hornets didn't appear. No one would have had to admit that. So, on the other hand, it's not trivial. Guerrilla operations are put down. Right? I assume that the Americans are going to be successful in Iraq and in the Philippines. They're fighting the communist insurgents for decades, and they still haven't overthrown the government. So the weak don't always overthrow the strong. I would say it happens a minority of the times. But it happens often enough, so that when it happens, it's not a spectacular open miracle like the crossing of the Red Sea, or when we conquered the city of Ai, where stones did fall from heaven on the defenders. Okay? That's what I mean. So it's worth speaking about it as a miracle in the broader sense, and in the prayers, the word miracle is usually used for the broader sense, something that God's will directly brings about, because it's easy to miss that it is so. You think it's a war, people are in the field, they're fighting, they're the ones who brought about the victory. Okay,
I hear it, but it's still hard to, in terms of how it says it, and like emphasizing it, it's still hard to say.
Look, you say in the tefillah every day, Yal Nisecha, Al Nisecha Shebechol Yom Imanu, Yal Niflosecha, Betovasecha Bechol Eid, Nisim Niflos, at every moment and every day. What does that mean? It doesn't mean the sea is splitting every day. So there, the word is used in prayer to mean God's direct causation is all around us. So, and this is an insert into the same prayer, written, I suppose, the same style, with the same sort of vocabulary. So I don't think it has to be taken a different way.